This is Laura Hamburg with Kate Magruder for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we're bringing you the story of Table Mountain Ranch, a commune in Albion which lasted for 20 years.
We'll hear from two of the commune's earliest settlers, Zoe Abel and Bill Heil. Bill, who describes himself as an aging hippie, runs a sawmill business, and Zoe is a lifelong educator.
Zoe grew up on the East Coast with her Yiddish-speaking grandmother. Bill was a Bible student in a German household in deep South Alabama. Zoe and Bill were each looking for their tribe. They found it on a piece of land at the end of Albion Ridge Road.
My name is Zoe Abel. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts, November 8, 1939. I think what shaped me as a young person growing up was being Jewish. I lived with my grandmother who had spoke Yiddish, and then I lived in an area where later when my mother remarried and I lived in an area where we were pretty the only Jewish family. So I think the sense of being different started actually at that time. So I came to the West Coast in 67. I was getting divorced and I had a one-year-old. And one day, we lived in Boston, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was dressing her to go outside and dressing myself to go outside. And by the time she had on all her snow things that she needed, and I went down the stairs and out into the snow, I stood there for one moment and said, I'm moving. And that was pretty much when I left the East Coast. I didn't know anything about California. I didn't know anything, period. Pretty much. And I came looking, there were people who were being arrested for political activities, and I thought, oh, maybe I can help take care of kids when they're jailed. And then there were the diggers in San Francisco. I met a man who lived in the Haight and just saw things that I had just very, very vaguely heard about. So I was looking for a place to have a group of people and do something with kids.
My name is Bill Heil. I was born in 1940 in Alabama. Alberta was a town that was a German settlement. Both of my grandparents were German immigrants. My grandfather belonged to some evangelical movement. He helped found a church called the Christian Missionary Alliance. The church was very much a part of my life. The way it affected me the most was it scared hell out of me. But I really thought that the world was going to come to an end and that I really had no choice but to get with the program. As I got older, I realized that there's something was wrong in what I believed. And I decided that I really had to do something about this predicament and not knowing if the world was going to end or... I'd come to realize that there were different views. The Bible actually was interpreted different ways. I thought that all I needed to do was learn enough, and I could understand what was going on. I think the more I studied, the more I realized that theology was not the answer. While I was at the University of Alabama, somebody had gotten a copy of the Oracle.
Remind us what the Oracle is.
The Oracle was an incredible psychedelic hippie newspaper that ran an interview with Timothy Leary and Alan Watts and people. I realized that that was much more in line with what I wanted to look for. So getting a chance to go to San Francisco, it was a group of us, and we caravanned across country as hippies from the University of Alabama in 1967. It was quite the adventure. There was a young man, probably about my age then, but he ended up with some money and a kind of loose ends and trying to figure out what to do. And people were talking about communes. And he decided to just go into Haight-Ashbury, rent a flat, and ask people to come live with him that he thought might be interesting to live with. One of those people actually was Zoe Abel. She was the one, she had an infant child at that time, a girl. She wanted to move to the country.
The man that I was, whose house I was staying in, which was a semi-communal house that was in San Francisco, he heard about a place for sale and he was looking. That's how come I moved to that house. We came up and basically he bought the place.
That place, Table Mountain Ranch Commune on Albion Ridge, was first seen from the air by Walter Schneider, a former Navy pilot. Walter had left the Pentagon after his awakening at Millbrook, Timothy Leary's New York estate. Enter Zoe Abel's friend, Duncan Ray, also of Millbrook, who was living communally with Zoe and others in a flat in Haight-Ashbury. It was 1968, just a year after the Summer of Love, and the Haight had begun to fray. The idea was to get out of the city and get back to the land. Walter and Duncan, connected by Millbrook, bought the ranch on Albion Ridge, 140 acres for $50,000. Word went out, and a commune was born.
I was the first person to come in 1968. When I came up with my daughter, Sanji, there were sheep, and the people were still living there. I was able to stay at a tin Quonset hut at the end of the land, and this young man and I tried to make a garden. We had no idea what we were doing, and it was like a parking lot. I mean, we're not very successful. Within a few months, we had a meeting of all the people who were interested in being there, from the house in San Francisco and from the people who came from Millbrook, and we said, okay, well, this is who we are, this is what we're doing. And we each talked about our visions, and I said I was going to work with kids. Many of us moved into an old sort of a place that they had planned to be a dude ranch, I think they called it. But there were some rooms, and there was a house. There was no electricity. And in terms of starting the commune, we did make some decisions. We decided to have meetings, to do things by consensus. I even think at that point, I think we even said we were going to share money and chores, and it just was falling into place. But we also had these ideas about how it was going to be. It wasn't just a free-for-all at all.
One of the things that neither Walter nor Duncan were committed to living on the land or being landlords. They both said, you know, Duncan said, I'll try it, and if I don't like it, I'll leave, and you all can continue it. One of the things not owning land means, or none of us having any, it really equalized our place on there. I couldn't say, well, I put in $50,000 and you only put in 10, so I should have more say about what goes on. None of us put anything in. So it was a great equalizer. I think that was one of the things that was most important. It also took the pressure off. I mean, most places, people were trying to buy land. And if you're trying to buy land, you have to be working or doing something to have an income. It turned out that what a lot of people ended up doing in California, of course, was growing marijuana. But we never did that at Table Mountain. By the time that really became a popular thing to do, we were into having a school. And that meant that we wanted to keep our hands really clean. I came to Table Mountain because I had some what we considered rural skills. When I moved there in January, it was winter, and everybody was trying to live in the big house. And it turned out that by the time spring came, everybody realized we've got 140 acres here, and we don't want to all be in one building. But we decided that if we built our buildings in the woods, the building inspectors couldn't find them. And it worked for that. But also, after living there for a while, we realized that building in the woods is not where you want to live.
Why?
It doesn't work because you just don't get enough sunlight. You know, it's always cold and damp. And we had plenty of firewood. And our buildings were really, I mean, it was hippies. You know, hippie building. At best, there were some ideas of how to do things differently. I think the whole movement of the 1970s was we got to do things differently. And I felt like Table Mountain Ranch, a lot of what we were doing was acting out these ideas that we had. And I think that was really the experiment we were having. The dropping out was pretty obvious. We just wanted to find a different way to do things, from growing our own food to educating our own kids. One of the things that Table Mountain really stressed, what I tried to deal with, was gender inequity. Everyone had to be what we called on the house one day a week. It meant that you took over the kitchen, made sure all the dishes got washed and the meal got served in the evening. I was the head of the motor pool, and sometimes we had what we called one-car consciousness, which among 10 or 12 people, we had one car that was running. And how to share that, and make, if you went to town, you did all the chores that needed to be done in town for everyone. And that car was on the road a lot. And I started repairing cars and pickups and decided that we ought to have one kind of car. And so we ended up collecting old Chevrolets as they died, or when we could find one that we could afford. Ended up with quite a boneyard. I called it Chevy Heaven for a number of years. So that was kind of my main focus, just being able to follow my conscience there. I realized that the war was still going on and that I didn't want to pay taxes. And the only way I could really, in good conscience, not pay taxes was not make money. That sort of thing. In terms of spiritual, we looked a lot at what we understood to be Native American culture and tried to follow it.
I did meet people who were from everywhere in the world who share certain values, look for a place where they can be with what they might call their tribe.
At some point, we kind of came up with the slogan among ourselves that blood is thicker than water, but consciousness is thicker than blood.
So in our example of trying to make these communes, if you look at places in England or old places, you know, that there wasn't just like there was this one house out. It was this 10 little houses out on that farm because they all lived in that little farm. And I think, you know, we were trying to take care of ourselves in some way. We were very bereft. I think we were, really, in some ways. And some people, it was both. I'm moving towards something that's healthier and that shares, that recognizes that being an individual is a very small part of what it means to be alive. And we've overdone that in America also, that individualism. And so it's a very small part. It's just being part of other human beings is the bigger part. I think it's important because it recognizes that bigger wholeness.
Was there a time when too many people came flooding into Table Mountain?
I said after a while, is that you can go out and see the world, or you can stay in one place and let the whole world come to you. And it seemed to me that Table Mountain was one of those magnets, even though it was off the road. One January, I think I counted like we'd had 100 visitors or something. That almost destroyed us in some ways. It seemed to me at some point we had too many people there and we didn't know what to do.
So Bill and Zoe and another communard, Marshall McNeil, who had come from Millbrook, decided to figure out a plan. It was 1970 and the clarion call to live rurally on the land was picking up steam. The three of them had to stem the endless flow of hippies coming from, well, everywhere, who wanted to join the commune.
Three of us got together and just talked about what to do and decided to propose everybody who wasn't there the Thanksgiving before had to leave the land. and they did, and we were going to have a retreat for a week, and after that we'd invite the people who we thought belonged there to come back. That event changed the direction of Table Mountain. After that, we really felt like we had some cohesiveness. It turned out that weekend we said that the retreat was over. It was Passover. And we really celebrated, I don't know how it happened exactly, except there were quite a few Jewish people ended up at Table Mountain. And we, looking as we kind of were, for guidance in that whole realm of spirituality.
So I was not really in touch with the Jewish aspect at that time. And I grew up in a town where I was not Jewish. I was atheist from 13 on. So that was that. The others, I don't know how they happened to come here from New York, all those Jews. I don't know. So we celebrated at Table Mountain. We used to have big crowds for Thanksgiving and Passover. There was a traveling rabbi, and then we imported someone. I think the history of Judaism had to do with being for the underdog, being equal.
Judaism was kind of one of the models, and celebration of Passover, which seems to be such a universal idea. But that first Passover that we celebrated was a moment when it dawned on me that I've been a seeker, you know, and trying to find my way. I would get this overwhelming, oh yeah, everything that I went through, my childhood, which seemed to be a real struggle at times. I don't think people, when I was a child, nobody really knew who I was or cared exactly, you know, that I wasn't exactly like everybody else or whatever. But there came a time at Table Mountain when I said, you know, it was all worth it. I'm here. I forgive my parents. I forgive everybody.
You just heard from Bill Heil, one of the first settlers in the late 60s to live on Table Mountain Ranch Commune in Albion. This is KZYX, Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories. I'm Kate Magruder with Laura Hamburg. Bill's friend, Zoe Abel, arrived at the commune before Bill in 1968. He described Zoe as a visionary. She founded the Whale School on Table Mountain Commune as an alternative to mainstream education. The grammar school lasted 20 years. Kids from Table Mountain went there, and later students from outside the commune attended as part of the Mendocino Unified School District.
Even when my daughter was little, we had a little preschool. And then I started the school basically around 71 when she was five. We started the school, and other people who were living there helped. There was always a group endeavor, but there were people whose vision or energy led things like the garden or the school or working off the land.
And how was the communal living aspect developing over those 20 years, over those years that the school was happening? Was the school right there on Table Mountain?
Yes. We built a building. There was a summer youth program, and we built a school building to code, and it was right there. And we didn't have phone or electricity either for a number of years. We finally got phones. And then another parent came and set up computers with a generator, and it was just was what it was. We did put running water in. The commune was the commune. I mean, they were separate, but many, many people, it was completely supported. The school happened because of the people that we lived communally. The theater program was a really big highlight, and many people were involved in that, and teachers came. My daughter's father was very involved after a few years, and we performed. The mime troupe performed with us up here. It's the only time they've ever done a double bill, as far as I know. We had a really good time with that. And then just things that people brought, woodworking and forge. We had a forge, and teachers came.
I had a shop that was right next to the school building. It had a forge in it. It had all my hand tools, and it had acetylene torches. And bring Ken in, say, what do you want to do? And we'd fire up the forge and made a lot of pokers, some which are still around. We made some pretty crude knives. The kids always want to be making knives, which is a very hard thing to make. But I ended up being what I call the mechanics teacher, and I did that a couple of days a week during the school year, where I would take all the kids, one or two at a time, and there were usually a dozen to two dozen students, as I recall, trying to teach kids how the world was put together, that all everything you see, everything you use, some person figured out how to do this. And if you're smart enough, you can figure out, or if you take the time, really, you can take it apart and put it together again yourself if you want to.
The kids, you know, I think there are kids who are happy they grew up that way. There are kids that are unhappy they grew up really communally. Oh, we would have preferred to have food. I didn't. I was with this other neighbor instead. I hate this person. I love this person. The grandkids that I have and those people are very interested in it. And that's what I found. Although I have to say, when my daughter went to college, she first wrote a paper about the school and about, she said, oh, college is easy. The hardest I ever worked was at the Whale School. In a different project. So I thought that was interesting, and I think that's probably common to other alternative places where kids are doing projects. But my granddaughter is very interested in how it affected her dad and her aunt and what it means now. A lot of the young people who live here now, a surprising number of them, in my opinion, are here again that I knew as kids. And not because they failed in the outer world, that they made a choice to be here. Yeah, I know there are educators, there are construction people, there are just people doing well here, a lot of kids that I knew. Being communal was a big thing. That we had neighbors who were communal. My lover was communal. My best friends were, you know, many of them were communal. And I also was going to say, mentioning about being gay, communes and gay women, and it was an important part because while I had the school, I don't know if you remember, but there was this law about you couldn't have gay teachers coming down the pike, and so I'm pretty sure that my superintendent and principal and everybody knew, but then I was lovers with a woman, but I had to tell them, and then we also had to do a contingent in the 4th of July parade because we had to. And there were lots and lots and lots of gay women over here and lots and lots and lots of professions. It was very important that that become known to the greater community that may not have known. So there were some people who had a lot to do with the regular community, but I wasn't one of them. I had a kid and school and a commune, so I was at the end of the road 90% of the time. We didn't even have to look at the question of what wasn't happening in public schools at the time to make a school because we lived at the end of a dirt road. They were in the dark riding to school and back. Even if I had loved the school, they would have been going in the dark and coming back in the dark. So that was a big factor, to be practical. And then I think the question of self-direction, was there, of self, seeing what the interests were, of maximizing personal development, of having a range of skills that had to do with land, the land itself, and just that living in the woods. These kids were different than those of us who had them there or brought them there. They were already different because they lived on different earth under different sky.
How would you say that the fact that you came out here and that you were living in the hate with a young man who helped buy Table Mountain and kind of turned it over to you guys to live there, how did that shape who you are now? How did that experience create you?
Is the question, did living communally for 20 years, how does it create me now?
Yes, and I think it's more than that. It's the fact that you got to come, that you came out here. You didn't stay on the East Coast. You came here. You came up here and did what you did in all of those different aspects. How did that impact you as a soul?
I hope I'm broad-minded and kind. I'm active in a Jewish justice group, and we're looking at making Mendocino solar. We're doing climate work in the whole county and seeing what we can do to help that happen. But there are people who changed a lot. There are people who came out of very different religious backgrounds or went into different professions. I'm not one of those people. I was sort of always this little kid with curly hair that didn't fit somewhere. And then I did fit, and then I didn't fit. And yeah, so I think it's hard for me to answer that question because of that.
How do you think that the fact that so many people came, like you at that time, what was the impact on the county? How did that shape? How did this influx of people shape Mendocino County.
Okay. Is pretty much all to the good. The arguments were over, you know, that yes, there were feuds, yes, there was terrible things, but really we got building codes paid much more attention to and got Class K happening. In the general plan, I believe there are still things that have not been implemented, but about clustering and so on. I haven't worked on this in a long time. I will again in relation to the energy work probably, but certainly the food movement here was influenced by the ones that came before, did their little organic farms, and now there are big organic farms. And culturally, the art scene was able to stay alive because of people who came and said, yeah, I'm going to be an artist, and I'm going to keep being an artist, and I'm going to go learn how to do pottery. And so I think it was to the good, basically, and also culturally in terms of what we're going through now in terms of learning more open and wide, I think is helping people to stay open now.
The important things that we've learned are the things that we've incorporated into our broader life. The fact that Mendocino County passed a law that says no GMO. That is a direct result of the Back to the Land movement. The people electing the first 5th district supervisor was an incredible accomplishment, and it was done by the Back to the Land people. Most of the people that lived at Table Mountain still live in the area and went on to be successful in what they were doing. Our kids, for the most part, have been successful.
Farmers, the whole food movement now is young people.
Exactly. I just realized there's a fellow now out on Middle Ridge who is doing a firewood business. He's doing it on his grandfather's land, who the people who helped write the local coastal plan done in the 70s said that his grandfather had a sawmill, and they zoned his land for that kind of rural industrial. He's utilizing what these Back to the Landers did by recognizing what it takes to have a rural economy.
So is there anything that you want to share, Bill, that we didn't talk about?
I think that was a lot of what people were doing in the 70s was, on the one hand, it had that conservative value of going back to the land. On the other hand, it was a totally new and forward-looking way of trying to deal with what's going on. And I think we're in a place very much so right now that we could make some of those breakthroughs that I think were made during the 70s.
You just heard from Bill Heil and his friend Zoe Abel. I'm Laura Hamburg with Kate Magruder for Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County. These interviews air each Thursday on KZYX. To listen to these stories and see photos of Bill and Zoe, visit the Promise of Paradise page on the KZYX website.
Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, Story Center, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.